Media Focus with Paul Blanchard.
And welcome to the first in our new Media Masters series, an extended one-on-one interview with those who have reached the very top of their game. And our first Media Master is Camilla Wright, editor and founder of PopBitch.
Media Focus.
So Camilla, what did you do before PopBitch?
I was working as a freelance journalist before and during the first 4 or 5 years, because PopBitch was just a hobby really for that time. Before that, I studied politics and was working in and around Eastern Europe.
So there's the rub, isn't it? PopBitch started as a hobby. What was the idea behind it?
Well, this was 2000, the start of 2000. So I don't think anybody then really knew what was going to happen on the internet, how you made a business out of it. So we looked at opportunities that were you got from the internet that you didn't really get anywhere else. Always wanted to start a magazine about pop music, pop culture, kind of smash hits for adults, smash hits married with Private Eye, that kind of thing.
That's but the tone, isn't it?
That's kind of where it came from. But you can't really start a magazine. The barriers to entry, unless you've got millions of pounds, are so high. But anybody can really send an email. So we thought it'd be fun to get together with friends in other friends in journalism and in PR, put some stories together, and basically share them. The idea was just to have a bit of fun between friends. The things that people weren't really publishing or didn't really want you to know, thought it might be fun to do, and then thought, hey, we might get a bit of a name for doing it. It can't be a bad thing. But it was never really intended to be a business or still be here 13 years later.
But you must have, like you say, you must have had an eye on that it might have succeeded. It's, you know, the backstop that it was really good fun and that you enjoyed it. But you didn't have plans for global domination even at that early stage then.
Well, I mean, nobody in the year 2000 knew how to monetize anything on the internet. I mean, there were no banner ads. We had to invent the technology really to send an email out to people because there were no email senders that you could afford. Bandwidth was enormous, so sites didn't have, you know, the video, didn't have ADSL connections like you have now. This was a dial-up world.
Wow.
That's really how it started, with being black text on white email and sending it out, because it's the only thing we could really do and the only thing people could afford to receive. So we never really thought it'd be public. It would just be a private list. And then people started, after about 3 or 4 weeks, people started asking if they could subscribe to it. So we thought, you know, we better work out how you have a database and then send them emails. And it kind of took off from there.
How did you kind of get the early tip-offs as to what was and wasn't happening behind the scenes?
It was just from people we knew in the industry.
So it was friends and family and colleagues at that point?
Yeah. I mean, the media world was a very different place then. The kind of constant bombardment of celebrity and popular culture news in broadsheets, BBC and tabloids. I mean, that wasn't really happening then. So there was a hell of a lot of stuff out there that wasn't being published. And I think it was then much easier for the management of stars to control what was being put out there. It was basically all the interesting things that we all laughed about and had fun at, and nobody then published or nobody then told the world, that we thought it would be fun to do. Almost like taking what insiders were talking about in a private members club.
Yes.
And just saying to everybody, do you know what? Everybody can hear this. Everybody can see this. So it was no more than that, really.
And were you ever worried, even at that stage, that you might get into trouble from, you know, publishing things that perhaps people didn't want to hear?
We thought people might shout at us, but legally, no. I mean, at the time, I don't think anybody really thought that laws applied to the internet. Nobody thought that libel and defamation was kind of anything to do with this newfangled internet thing. So, I mean, we really thought we could get away with anything. And for about a year, I think we did. But yeah, there was always a danger you'd upset the wrong person, but it always seemed worthwhile doing.
So for a year, you got away with it scot-free, and then what happened?
For about a year, PopBitch was just a weekly newsletter that you could subscribe to. You gave us your email address and we sent it out. But then we came up with a forum, a message board. It was open from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. You could post anything you want and talk about any rumours or...
Isn't that amazing that it would have opening hours?
How
dated, how quaint.
We actually kept the opening hours for a while to make it look... Well, partly because we didn't want people to be doing it all the time.
Yeah.
Partly so there was a sense of the coming in and going to school or going to work kind of thing. We then started Night Bitch, which was the 10 p.m. to 5 a.m. And then it got a completely different crowd in. So for some reason, once a day, every day, somebody came on the message board using a different name, accusing a well-known celebrity of
being a paedophile.
Being a paedophile, yes. It was almost like a joke. It was just the sort of joke a person came on. Nobody took any notice.
Well, Private Eye has its regulars, doesn't it? That people write in every week to the letters page for the Andrew Neil picture with that young woman.
Yeah, this was just a slightly, more difficult take on
yes,
that.
Yes, exactly.
This celebrity's lawyers got in touch to say that this was not something that they were comfortable with. So we went away and reinvented the technology so that you had to register to use our forums. And that kind of got rid of the problem because people then felt much more responsible.
Traceability, as it were. But at that point, could they still post anything they wanted on there? They had to register, but at that point, they could still stick stuff. That, like, for example, the celebrity, they could still say that, but you'd at least be able to trace them.
And also, we could then moderate it if we wanted. We could make sure that those words or that person was looked at before their posts went up. So we had a little bit more control over it. But most people weren't trying to cause trouble. They just were doing it accidentally. This was just a one-off.
So you were having editorial challenges, legal challenges, and technical challenges as well in terms of you having to deliver the newsletter and manage, user registrations, etc. It must have been a nightmare.
It didn't seem like a nightmare because it was so near. It was like, this is exciting. We don't really know what we're doing. I'm not sure it was so exciting for people who were trying to get the newsletter at the time. They probably were not getting it quite so easily. But so that was the first sign that people's publicists, management, lawyers were looking at things that were being written about them on the internet. And I think that was probably towards the end of 2000. So already, 12 years ago.
12 years ago then, were PR people seeing you as a threat at that point, that something to be managed, that they didn't want their clients in it? Because, I work in PR. I'd be delighted if some of my clients were in Popbitch. The exposure and the readership you have is absolutely fantastic.
It's split. It's true. A lot of people quite are delighted, no matter what is said about them, to be in the pages. They think they're more relevant and it's more important to be talked about. And also a lot of the celebrities we talk about are on our readership list, so they quite like gossiping about their friends and about themselves. But I think when it's things that were seen to be manageable and perhaps difficult for their personal brands, that's when the lawyers got involved. I think also it became a business opportunity for a lot of law firms and a lot of publicity firms. They could offer reputation management through the internet as a, fee-paying
An extra thing that they could get money for. Absolutely.
So then we found quite quickly a lot of people, certain publicity groups, certain law firms had somebody, 24 hours a day monitoring the message boards just to make sure there was nothing untoward about their clients and making sure. And there was a period when you would get a legal letter every week. Wow. It was never what you thought it was going to be in trouble. It was always something else. But I think that was just a sort of gold rush when the period when you thought you could get away with anything on the internet ended. It was suddenly a free-for-all. How much were they going to be able to stop?
But I imagine the first lawyer's letter must have come as a shock. But by the time it was the 20th, you must have had a system in place. At least you just went away and made a cup of tea or something and thought, what are we going to do? Or did it always come as a shock? Did you always think this is the end of Popbitch with every solicitor's letter?
To be honest, most law firms want to work with you. And most publicists, most management want to work with you. They want to come up with some sort of solution that makes them not look too stupid. But they don't really want to cause a fuss. They don't want to look like they didn't get the joke. So it's been... It's not been that difficult.
When you deal with PR people, do they get it? Do they ring up kind of naively or email you just saying, can you put our celebrity client in for no reason? Or do they ring up slightly, better educated and better informed, that they try and give you an angle, something they know your readership and they know what the kind of thing you want and kind of feed that? Or is the kind of stories you get always quite kind of surreptitiously gathered still?
It depends. I mean, some people do ask, either ask to get their celebrity in or get you to cover something you're never going to do. Sometimes people pretend to be a fan, I've just come across this person on the internet and I think this YouTube ads, thing is really good. So you get that as well.
You can tell it a mile off,
You can tell it a mile off.
I mean, when I'm emailed, sometimes it's meant to look tailored, but you can just tell it's a generic thing, can't you? I don't understand why they do it.
You know what it's like as a good publicist. You want to build a relationship with somebody, make friends with them. it's more people in me in the media industry love to gossip. I think.
Yeah, they do. I love Pop Bitch because of that. I've subscribed for years and years, and it's because of that. You know, even the fact when you tantalisingly kind of hint at who it might be, that's part of the fun, I think.
Yeah.
I think if you didn't hint, I think you once said to me a while ago that sometimes knowing who they are actually removes the fun out of it.
Absolutely. If it's a great story about a really boring person, you take the name out and it becomes a much more exciting story.
So you kind of got into, you realised that it wasn't going to be trouble-free for after the first year, but you mentioned that you were still doing freelance work for the first few years. Was Pop Bitch a kind of part-time project at that point?
It was sort of evenings and weekends. I don't think at the time anything really, there was very few things making money on the internet, very few people who wanted to advertise on the internet. It happened for us about the end of 2003 when Diesel came to us and said, "Love Pop Bitch. What can we do? You know, how can we get Diesel involved with you? What can we give you some money to be associated with it?" And that was the first sign that we thought, hang on a minute, there's something to this digital business. Mm. And that's when it became much more of a full-time thing.
Was it scary?
Very scary. It's still scary because it's a weekly. It's still scary. You always think things happen on a weekly basis. Someone's going to shut us down or someone's not going to pay. So, yeah.
I mean, could you describe a typical week?
It's really based around the cycle of the newsletter, which comes out on a Thursday lunchtime or there or thereabouts, depending on how anyone's hangover is in the office, really. What you write about on the Thursday tend to bring other stories in. Probably about a quarter of our stories come from people we know, people we'll see out at things, people who want to give you tips.
The usual suspects.
Usual suspects. Probably another quarter come from people who you know who they are, but they email in very occasionally because they only have stories occasionally or they only have certain areas they're interested in telling you about. And probably the other half comes from people who you don't know who they are or people you've never met before and either through email or phone calls want to pass on some stories. So that sort of starts on about Thursday afternoon. Once you've sent something out, people then feed something and think, "Oh, I know a bit more about that person. Actually, that's not true. It goes like this." So through Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, then you get a huge amounts of things sent in. Monday, Tuesday, probably filter through it a bit. And then you work out the thing. Do we have enough for this week? Oh my God, are the stories we've got now still going to be available Thursday or is somebody else going to break it? Which does happen quite a lot in a weekly.
Of course.
So that all happens. And then there's always the sort of what's going on in the media as well. So you can see what other stories are out there and whether or not you can add a more analytical perspective or a different side of the story if something's gone in the tabloids at the weekend. And that's really why we've stayed as a weekly, because it gives you the 6 days really to think about what else is out there. I think if you want to be a 24/7 operation, you're always commenting on the now without really thinking about why did that just happen.
So Pop Bitch is pioneer of the slow news movement then, is that right?
I don't know if it's the slow news movement, but I think it just gives a different perspective on the 24/7 news movement.
I mean, clearly you can trust your usual suspects and the kind of semi-regular suspects, as it were, but you said about half the tips just come in from thin air. How do you know whether they're true or not? Because it could be someone trying to stitch them up, it could be someone with a mental illness, someone who's got nothing better to do. How does that work?
We do get that a lot. I think you build up a sixth sense for something that you're nervous about, you're worried about. I mean, there's hundreds of stories come in. Some of them might well be true, but you just can't touch them because you just have no idea one way or the other. Sometimes you know that you've missed things, but quite a lot of the time, I think you're pretty sure that these aren't right. We had one last week when someone who, a famous celebrity who has famously gone through rehab, been clean for a while, and this person was emailing in with so much detail about what they were taking, what drugs they were taking, where they'd been, where they'd been seen. I mean, it was a campaign of that you looked incredibly plausible, but it just didn't feel right. So it's worth checking out.
So why would they do it? Are they just bored? Are they idiots? Or what is it? Are they trying to inconvenience you? Is it something anti-Pop Bitch, as it were? Do you have enemies, as it were?
I think some people like the idea of being able to place fake stories.
What, maybe for fun?
For fun.
Just like maybe someone would want to go train spotting.
I think so.
How bizarre.
Maybe you're on the internet. I mean, people have strange habits on the internet. I mean, who would want to be an internet troll? But it obviously amuses people. So I guess there's a lot of people who do that. There's some people who might want to inconvenience somebody else in their sector, somebody else's client. It could be somebody from a rival magazine or something like that. could be just someone, you know, one you thinks it's funny. And it's I'm sure everybody has printed things that were done in that way, but
you did in good faith.
In good faith. But you try and filter them out. If you start a dialogue with them, if it's a story that's true, it tends to stop there because they don't know anymore. You know, they saw somebody in a pub, that was it. But if it's a story that's been concocted, there's always extra details. There's always something more to add. And you sometimes think, this is too perfect. Nothing.
So it's good. It's good old-fashioned detective work then on your part.
That's one of the fun bits, trying to work out if the really interesting thing someone's told you is true, which is probably just the same sort of, it might be a different way of journalism now, which is online, but it's probably the same sort of thing that people have been doing, you know, since tablets and
Time immemorial. So you get a piece of tittle-tattle in from mm-hmm. a party at the weekend and it you think it stacks up. Do you have a process editorially in terms of, do you go to that celebrity or that person's lawyer? Do you go to put it to them? Or do you just kind of write it? And I mean, because people that you write about wouldn't need a writer reply anyway, would they? Because it's clearly a kind of light-hearted piece of gossip. No?
We wouldn't go to them for comment, and we wouldn't check it out with the lawyers because we'd just assume we'd either get told it wasn't true or the story would be taken to a friendlier publication instead.
I think that happens a lot.
We'd probably try and do quite a bit of checking up to see if it stacked up. But if anyone ever wants a writer, it's very rare that you would deny somebody a right of reply in the next issue. We've done it many times to people who've said, this didn't work this way, or actually you got this bit wrong, or this is just plainly untrue.
I wasn't
untrue.
In Carphone Warehouse. I was wherever.
Exactly.
Yeah, I love them.
I was
the
in
best
Vodafone.
Ones. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I love those. What kind of relationship do you have with your readers? You've got your people who tip you off, but are they quite active? Would they, like me, for example, I've emailed in over the years mm-hmm. two or three times with the odd celebrity spot, and I've always been incredibly pleased when I've seen it, you know, actually in the newsletter.
Yeah, one of the worst things you can do is to forget to thank the person at the bottom with their pseudonym or their initials. People get so upset if they've sent something in and not been thanked, and it's a horrible thing to do because when you do it, it's purely by accident.
Yeah, it's not deliberate, is it?
People will email in if they don't like the tone of what you've done. You know, we have our own sort of PCC, I guess, in the readership. If people think you've been mean or that you've got the tone wrong or that something wasn't fair, you get a lot of people emailing in. Also, if you think they haven't been mean enough, you got the tone wrong and you should have been meaner, you get a lot of people emailing in. I always think if people bother to email in and they don't sound like they're shouting at you or being mental, you should probably listen to what they're saying. They're probably right.
The first thing I do when I get pot bitch, and this is a true story, is I scroll down to the old jokes home at the end.
I think whenever we've surveyed people, more than half the people say they do that.
Because it gives a genuine chuckle. Half the jokes I know but I haven't heard for 15 years since its name. But some of them are genuinely quite new and I chuckle away to myself and then I scroll up to the top and I start reading the gossip. So I wonder if people do have that kind of relationship where they read it in a certain way and in a certain context.
People read the joke and then read the stories and then probably later on go and look through some of the links and things like that. I think that's very much how it's done. If you forget the joke or you do a bad joke or you've done a joke that you've had before, that's the thing people will let you know about instantly.
What, so people will reply and say that joke wasn't sufficiently funny?
Yes.
Why would they take their time out of their busy schedule to do that? And how do you react to something like that? Do you reply and just tell them to get lost? Or?
I ask them if they've got a better one.
One of the things I wanted to ask you about was kind of spin-offs. You know, Pot Bitch is a commercial organisation. It pays your wages. You must have been inundated with lunatics over the years that have come up with ideas. So, for example, you know, the two that sprung to mind immediately for me was a kind of Pot Bitch Old Jokes Home book, some kind of e-book where all of them, since from the very beginning, I'd pay £3 for that. I wonder if, you find a few other 1,000 people that do that, might make some money. And then I know you couldn't do this one, but I've always thought, you know, pay £15 direct debit for Pot Bitch Plus, where you actually name the people rather than just hint at them and say it was Derek Smith in Swindon that did this.
Well, God, if we've actually so many times thought of how we could do that, giving people the answers to the things that you can't publish. So if anyone's got an idea, they should just, you know, let us know. Email us at hello@potbridge.com because it would be a lot of fun to do it.
But, I mean, you've stuck to the, without sounding kind of in terrible marketing speak, you've stuck to the core brand of Popbitch, which is a text-based weekly newsletter. Mm-hmm. You've got the forums. You've now moved into iPad apps. I mean, what's next for it as a business and as a brand?
Well, we've tried different things over the years. We had a radio Popbitch for a while, but it's so expensive to run radio streams that it becomes more of a labour of love than something that was then going to end up being commercial. We've done books. We did a book with Random House, Big Coffee Table Book. We've published our own Who Would Win in a Fight Between a Baboon and a Badger. Got 100 different famous people to answer that. I think Baboon Badger 2 should be out for Christmas.
Out soon.
There's been ideas of TV, of other things, but I think you have to work out what you can do and what you can do well.
The problem is anything you do that might build on it might also detract from it and might reduce its Popbitchness, if that makes sense.
No, I completely agree. That's why I think we were waiting for things like easy tablet and phone publishing to come about, because it's not much of a stretch to move from what we do now, the core weekly, to something that's a little bit more in depth. So some of the stories that you want to do much more depth of them, much longer, sometimes a bit more pictorial, a bit more video based, that you can't do in a weekly newsletter. I think we're finding a home for that. So it's a sort of Popbitch and Popbitch Plus, really. That seems so far to work. People, the feedback on it has been really positive. So touch wood.
Touch wood. Well, Camilla, thank you for coming in. Do you want to just give our listeners a heads up on how they can subscribe to Popbitch, download the iPad? What are the websites and so on that they need to know about?
You can find everything at popbitch.com. There's a place to subscribe to the email newsletter. It will also click you through to the App Store, where our iPad magazines are, which is obviously in the App Store as well, on Newsstand. And you can follow us on at Popbitch on Twitter, although don't expect too many tweets.
Tip-offs to hello at popbitch.com?
Tip-offs to hello at popbitch.com. Absolutely.
Last question then. How many emails do you get a day?
Somewhere between hundreds and thousands.
Wow.
Probably hundreds.
Wow. Well,
but we always try and make sure that the best tip-offs we get a drink for, at least.
I can imagine. Well, Camilla Wright, editor of Popbitch, thank you for coming in. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Paul.
A Big Things Media production.